Welcome to the Frog Logic Podcast. I'm your host, David Rutt Rutherford. And man, I just want to say thank you to all of you who wrote in, not only about my last show, the Trump presidency, the Trump presidency eulogy, letting go. I really appreciate that, as all of you might have heard in my voice. As you know, I love the fact that America can work, but I'll tell you this, after watching this last process, I think we need to tighten the ship up and start getting a lot more focused on what's going to happen within our elections, within the states, and be conscientious of our liberties and what's happening right now, especially with the new For the People bill that's in the House of Representatives. So take a look at that and just be heads up on what's coming down the pike from the federalization of U.S. elections. You're going to love this one. All right. I also want to say thank you to everybody and all the amazing comments. Evan Hafer from Black Rifle Coffee had me on Free Range America podcast last week. And I was able to really dig into what was going on, what was happening over the last few months with me. And it was such a relief. And I just can't thank Evan enough. If you want to listen to a great podcast with lots of cool veterans telling veteran stories and laughing and jokes, and he just had J.P. Sears on the other day, and they just hilarious show. Go check them over out at Black Rifle Coffee and the Free Range American podcast. Sign up for that. And for this episode, I can't even begin to tell you. I've met a lot of incredible, incredible human beings within my performance coaching, within my activities as a motivational performance coach, working with professional sports teams and athletes and collegiate sports teams and athletes. I've met just an incredible amount of amazing people, as well as in the CIA and in the SEAL teams as an instructor in both of those, as well as an operator. And just my other experiences as a nationally known motivational speaker, working with companies from Bank of America to small insurance companies, to large insurance companies, to the largest family-owned pork provider, and everything in between, man. It's been an incredible experience. I've seen a lot of great performance within people, and I've been able to study it myself really for the past 30 years. I was a collegiate Division I athlete, and man, I just, it's my passion to understand the human condition, really, to explore, experience, and research the human condition on every level. And as you've listened to my podcast in the past, one of the main things I like to focus on is performance. So today's guest, God, this guy's incredible. His name is Jay Harrison. Jay Harrison is a former NHL hockey player who played with the Toronto Maple Leafs, the Carolina Hurricanes, the Winnipeg Jets. Had a great career. Was known as a brawler and a bruiser. In fact, there's some great video out there of him beating the snot out of people. It's pretty amazing. But what people don't understand, and what makes Jay so fascinating in my mind, and again, thank you, Mike Rickard from Boston Red Sox, for hooking me up with Jay, is that Jay is now a clinical psychologist, and he's an entrepreneur and athlete transition specialist, which is very similar to veteran transitions. And he's a clinical mental health counselor. I mean, this guy's as smart as it gets when it's out there. And I've just learned so much in the short amount of time I've gotten to know him over the last 6 to 9 months, I think it was around there. And I'm just so happy that I finally got him to come on. I think it's a great way to jump into this year and the Frog Logic podcast. So you'll enjoy this show today. Make sure if you have friends that are into performance and performance ideas, share the show with them if you could. You know, in terms of where I'm available and I'm at, I'm still not on Instagram or Facebook or Twitter, and I have no intention of going back on. Just this whole freedom of speech thing is just atrocious. In fact, I just saw Who did Twitter suspend? Mike Lindell. Twitter decided to suspend the MyPillow guy because he's such a threat to America, right? And it's just the suppression of free speech. And I just for general purpose, I cannot support organizations that suppress free speech. It's not okay. So if that's the case, I don't have a home right now. You can find me on LinkedIn. You can certainly go to my website. We're getting ready to start regular. We have regular newsletters going out, weekly newsletters that'll have shows, writings of mine, other things that come up, new merchandise, new offerings. All of it will be there because I'm going to drive most everything back to my website now at teamfroglogic.com. So head over to teamfroglogic.com, set us a note, sign up for the newsletter. You won't regret it. Also, if you're interested in an online speech for your organization, I've given about 32 or three of those things since COVID started, and just gave one the other day, and I've got a couple more coming up in the next couple weeks. So I am available. I've got a great speech for you and your organization called Pandemic Motivation, Finding a Pathway Through the Pain. You'll dig it. It's about a 45-minute speech that really helps people understand the significance of the state, limbic state you've been in, how to address it, how to deal with it, how to deal with each other from a team orientation. That's really my specialty, is helping teams and individuals maximize their ability to perform under the most extreme environments imaginable. All right. Also, I'm doing a lot of coaching now. I work with teams and players as well as executives. I got a big executive coaching thing going on right now. If you're also interested in my curriculum, we've got some great online curriculum. Right now, we have the Embrace Fear course. We've run two of those courses starting last fall. We're going to start the next Embrace Fear course in mid-February, as well as hopefully we're going to get done with the Forging Self-Confidence course. So if you're struggling with learning how to embrace your fear, and that is to understand it, accept it, train with it, learn to reroute it, and then live with courage through your fear, then this is the course for you. I know everybody's been inundated with fear over the last 10, 11 months, so this is the course that's going to help you manage all that. And then my Forging Self-Confidence course is based on the book I wrote back in 2011 and 12, which helps individuals be able to fight the negative insurgency every single day with 8 simple missions of how to do that. And that course, we're hoping to be ready by the end of February. I'm also working on some incredible curriculum with Dr. Chris Free, a clinical psychologist at the University of Hawaii, as well as an incredible activist within the veteran community, doing pro bono work with over 100 special operations members and intelligence members and their wives and kids and children to help them in their process of transition, as well as to deal with all of the effects of what he is now becoming infamous for, which is a paper he authored with some other folks called Operator Syndrome. In this paper, he fully describes the magnitude of medical issues that operators with many years in special operations with multiple combat deployments, how it affects us on a whole totality, significant group of issues, from traumatic brain injuries to endocrine issues to post-traumatic stress, family issues, sleep issues, everything you can think of that's involved, in, which is comes out to be about 16 different things. So we are in the process of designing an Operator Syndrome course, not only for operators and their wives and families, but also for healthcare providers, because you walk into a VA or your local doctor or anybody and you say, I've got Operator Syndrome, they're going to look at you like you have a third eye. So go over to my website at thefroglogicinstitute.com, and you can see what we got going on over there and sign up as well there for future classes. Or again, go back to teamfroglogic.com and sign up for our newsletter, so you'll have all different types of heads up and what's coming down the pike for us. So that's the deal. All right. Without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, stand by for this, because this guy's smart. All right. Here we go. Jay, let me tell you something. One time you said this statement, all right? You said this. You said, ignorance is bliss until someone points it out. What did you mean by that? Let's start out right there.
Hey, Dave, how you doing? We're a great place to start. You know, trying to remember, I feel like that line has kind of, you know, worked for me and against me in so many ways in my life. And I think I actually stole it from a neurophysicist at some point talking about something that was probably way over my reading level at the time. But it certainly resonated with the power of knowledge and knowing, and also the gift and curse of ignorance in many ways. Recognized on both sides of that aspect, how powerful knowledge and seeking knowledge can be, and being aware specifically to your own experience. And, you know, for the most part, it's interesting. Most of the time that sounds like kind of a negative statement, more is better. But oftentimes in our world, knowing what's right in front of you and dealing with what you see during the day and accepting what's in your control requires a degree of ignorance and a degree of kind of that blissful wandering perspective and mindset, which at times I undervalued, certainly in my experience as we get to. So recognizing, finding, you know, you come back to a middle path of seeking awareness and knowledge, but also recognizing that there's a spot where you need to be in focus in order to be your best as well, can be incredibly powerful as well. And that's probably one of the takeaways, that statement is a double entendre of sorts. But I've come to accept it and live by it on a whole bunch of different levels and see it from 360 degrees.
Well, it's really fascinating. You know, as in the intro to the show, I talked a lot about your professional experience, your fighting, your propensity for fighting, and how somehow that they labeled you as this fight guy, which is, you know, so counterintuitive to getting to know you, you know. And I just want to give a shout out to Mike Rickard from the Red Sox who introduced us. And it's been such an honor and a privilege in the times that we've gotten to share with one another. Because what the reality is you're the furthest thing in the world from an ignorant human being, right? You believe in every aspects of pushing yourself to that next level of performance, and most, I think, acutely pushing yourself from a mental conditioning perspective. And as I went through all of a lot of the stuff that was available on you out there, you really hear that quite a bit in how you reference performance, right? It is this incremental shift. It's the awareness that you talked about and all the little aspects that you can tweak here and there, and you tweaking them in real time. You're tweaking them for the long term. And I just wanted to, you know, just bring up another, you know, something that you'd said, and you said the difference between an elite athlete and someone really good is narrow. And if you can show those pathways from a mental conditioning perspective, how do you get that person who's really good into becoming elite?
Yeah, that is certainly $1 million question.
Those are the only questions I ask on this show.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, and there's a fluidity to the highest level of performance, which I'm sure you've come, and I've always been fascinated in my practice now as an athlete watching it, you know, maybe having, you know, brief sparks of truly aligning with that, you know, fullest, you know, acclimation of your potential, but watching others do it far more regularly and chasing that and understanding the chase and how you go about cultivating that and living that has taken me on a very unique path. And you hear me talk a lot about these two very, you know, important concepts in my world. They're kind of the yin and yang, and one is performance and one is wellness. And you put them together, you have this performance wellness, and that's kind of a juxtaposition of sorts.
Yeah.
In that while they are related, they're certainly not synonymous.
Well, it's interesting. Sorry to jump in real quick, but in one of our talks before, I remember we talked about that challenge of performance and the requirement for the ultimate sacrifice, right? If you're going to be an elite performer, you have to be willing to push yourself beyond what everybody else is doing, right? You have to ignore that, find your own pathway, and just be willing to sacrifice access to your family, personal things. And so, you know, you do put in that wellness component. And I know that's a big part of your assessment in terms of, if you're going to play, at least enjoy playing as well too. You can play at an elite level and enjoy it. And so that I love the fact that you incorporate the wellness in that, that's a component, and it doesn't have to be what is sacrificed most, right?
Well, yeah, it's something that I've realized when you watch the highest performers, and we talk about that space that they occupy, and there's something very natural about it. And in order to do that, you kind of look at their performance from a whole bunch of different angles, and you look at their lifestyle. And a number of things that really stand out is that, you know, a lot of athletes I found, and I think this is probably, you know, you could confirm for me in the military space as well, is because of how we're groomed and raised in the culture to which we grow up, we often, you know, recognize the privilege of what we do and the honor and the responsibility and accountability that comes with what we do, that we're willing to do it and be unwell. In fact, it's the more I'm unwell, the more it's worth it. And we kind of have a couple of these, you know, kind of counterproductive and maladaptive back doors that we overcome a lot of the cognitive, dissonance that we might experience around living our best lives through what we do. So I often say one of my primary, you know, goals and aspirations when I work with, whether it's athletes or anyone, is to live your best life through what you do, whether that's through the sport or through that aspect of your identity, rather than sacrificing your best self to do what you do.
Let me ask you a quick question in there then. I mean, I love the maladaptive backdoor. That's just genius right there, brother. But let me ask you this. As you know, one of the things I always see with young athletes, right, and as well as in special operations, you see, you know, from an early age, this containment mentally of what their focus needs to be, right? If I want to be a great football player, I got to behave like this football players behave. If I want to be a great Navy SEAL, I got to behave like a Navy SEAL plays. And it almost creates these blinders, right? Mm-hmm. From that, like you said, that adaptive wellness perspective, where you're not only are you, you know, refining the intricacies of the technique required, the mindset required, the perseverance required, but also like you're explaining, hey, you should also be learning how to play the fiddle or playing the guitar or be an artist or work for a nonprofit. I mean, that actually benefits your performance. When did you first recognize, hey, that's what we need to do? Because right from like 5 years old, all you see is I want to be a Division I player. Or I want to play in the pros, and you seem to lose everything else.
That's a really great perspective and question. That certainly is something that we tend to adopt an identity and a mythos around how we're supposed to be in order to fulfill that. And not only is that something that's internalized, it's also reflected and, you know, maintained by the cultures of what we do, probably even more so in special.
Exactly. Lives.
Because of the significance of what you do. But in sports, you know, it's kind of a bit more of a culture and a lifestyle and an identity to which you adopt the same motivational pursuits and practices to achieve everything. And you get into a whole bunch of those if then, well, if I do this, then I can't do that kind of mentality in order to fit that structure. And I found, anecdotally for my career, I became my best player when I realized I wasn't an athlete anymore.
People are going to hear you say that, Jay, and they're going to be like, what is this guy talking about?
Well, that's exactly what 19 and 20 year old kids, you know, say to me too. But when I actually realized that there was more to me than just the wins and losses and what I was able to achieve in the game, what I valued for so long, I started to actually get a hint of a reflection of other parts of me that people valued, the contributions I could make. In other aspects of my life, for me, that was through academics. You know, I traditionally actually pursued pre-med degree and you know, hung around with docs quite a bit through sports because I had great sports docs around me all the time. I loved to learn. I loved what they did. They fascinated me and I was quick on the uptake. It gave me a whole bunch of energy. And I found that the more I invested, well, what I call divested my identity into other aspects of myself, the more free and open I was to actually do, you know, my career, my sport, play the game freely. I was able to simply put the game in a place where it belonged, which is what it is. It's a game. And I kind of call this, and I attribute this to the fact that I was able to bring more positive things with me to sport. We often talk in a mindset, don't take your bad stuff, your crap home with you, and let that impact other areas of your life. I like to kind of flip that with more of a positive perspective. Like, well, what are you doing away from that sport, away from that career that you're going to bring and make you feel good at the rink when things might not be so good? So whether I had a good game or a bad game, I still, you know, went home and had the same routine. This, that made me feel good about myself. I had that sense of purpose, that self-efficacy, that I was contributing to something, rather than just being held to the results of a game. And I found that incredibly freeing. And I found that my performance changed dramatically, and I was able to get, you know, pretty much another decade out of myself.
That's amazing.
Sport. So,
that was what was blew me away. I was like, all right, hockey's probably one of the most debilitating sporting events that you can participate in. I mean, the magnitude of stress put on the body, magnitude of impact, right, from CTE or you know, all the different things that we've talked about in the past. And then, you know, just the pace and just the extent and the grueling nature of performance that is within hockey. It's amazing that you know, when you leave the rink, you could, you know, go back to that divested identity and say, all right, I'm just Jay, father of four girls, right? I'm just Jay, the husband. I'm Jay, the student. I'm Jay, the musician.
Yeah.
And was it easy to be able to transfer your focus like that?
Well, sometimes it was when, you know, like I say, those motivational aspects that made me an effective athlete, they translate very well to certain areas of your life. For example, you know, like as you mentioned, a musician, played since I was very young, that discipline to practice and get it wrong 1,000 times before you get it right. Something that, you know, I attribute to a mindset. I think it's a little bit harder to find in kids who just like to practice, and the value of practice is different. But there's also something else there that I've hit on, and it was reflected back to me by, you know, a mentor of mine, Paul Check, from the Check Institute in California, who I've had some, you know, an opportunity to work with. And he frames it as working in. Yeah.
Wow.
And a lot of athletes and people who are, you know, traditionally very competitive and use that motivational, you know, ambition and determination, competitive self-realization kind of constellation, they tend to work out really well, right? We'll continue to work out. We'll keep working out, and we spend little time actually working in and cultivating a little bit of a different presence, a different energy within ourselves. And that's kind of been a little bit of that secret sauce to better understanding how we can divest, how we find value in what we do, meaning and purpose. Consistently, athletes I find are always externally evaluated. There's an extrinsic component to everything that we do.
Measured constantly. Every single
matter how you thought you played.
Yeah.
It's what everybody else thought you played, from the media to your coach to the general manager. So all of these aspects come into this, well, I don't really value finding value in myself. And that's something that kind of has to shift over time. And I found that academics was a way and a pursuit to contribute to the athlete experience in a different way that resonated with who I truly was so helpful in acclimating my fullest potential and playing to a level that I was capable of. Mind you, it wasn't the highest level by any stretch, you know, but certainly I got far more out of myself than the traditional approach I brought to my career in the first 5 or 6 years.
Well, it's interesting when you talk about, you know, certainly not the highest level. Well, and it's funny, here you are, professional athlete, a doctor of psychology, you know, you're involved in all these incredible, you know, you're a success finder, certified, you know, a coach, you're part of this great company, Game Change. And yet, you know, you're still measuring yourself at the lower levels of performance within the NHL, you know, and we do the same thing in the military, right? In special operations. If you don't have, you know, nowadays, if you don't have 8, 9, 10 combat deployments under your belt with 400, 500, 600 combat missions, then you're not equatable to being the best, right? You're not at, You're not at a tier one unit. You're not this. So it's for me, it becomes, you know, when I'm working with athletes in particular, is managing those measurements, right?
Management is the key word, right? I don't want to take them away because that's part of your edge.
Right.
Right. It's recognizing, you know, how and why they function and how they manifest in our life and when they're helpful and when they're not, choosing an alternative approach when suitable. I find, you know, when you haven't done very much in your career and then you transition and you have relatively, you know, you've internalized very little value for what you've done.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't do anything. Well, good luck doing anything.
If that's the starting point, right? Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Value that. If you didn't value that, then there's nothing you're going to value about yourself. And I think we probably got to drill down a little bit and understand, you know, how some of that come to be and recognize how, you know, how it did serve you for quite a while and thank it. But in many ways say, well, there might be an alternative perspective to that ignorance is bliss. And until someone points it out that you've had one of the most successful careers in your field and you don't think very much of yourself for it is an interesting inflection point in somebody's development.
Well, it goes back to that mental conditioning, right? When you're exposed to a particular program over a long period of time, the indoctrination process becomes easier, right? The more you begin to, where you hit that point of resistance, and then you submit to what the standards are going to be, right? The standards on your team, the standards of the external measurements of the league, the external measurements, like you said, of the media. That was the one that blew me away, right? When I started working with the Red Sox, I remember sitting with Dave Dombrowski and John Farrell, and they're like, hey, listen, you need to really incorporate the evaluation from the players of the 35 news organizations that covered the Sox in Boston. And then on the road, they had 22 writers that traveled with the team. You know, the average for most groups are, you know, one or two maybe from the hometown travels. But, and it was like, wait a minute, how big of a deal is this? And they're like, it's massive. And then I said, well, you know, first thing I hit is, why has it become so massive? You know, why has it become such an integral part? And it, you know, obvious, there's obvious business reasons for sure. But, you know, it's going back to that mental conditioning. It's almost as if there's a point where that athlete goes from that ideological, that the idealism of playing, the beauty of the sport, the appreciation of the game, the love of competition, the love of the fight, you know, literally and figuratively, to where the business aspect kind of closes in on that perspective. Did you feel that pretty extensively?
Yeah, and you kind of bring up a good point. And from an athlete's perspective, there are a couple of different experiences, like we talk about, and we look at these the highest performers and, you know, like, you know, king of the jungle kind of way that they don't have to worry about things of people who are a little bit lower on the food chain.
Right.
You know, the survival element. So there are different experiences, but you're absolutely right. Those who are able to really control what they can control, and then they have an orientation towards it. You can learn from it. Some people are a little bit more inclined to just have that, you know, that sense of decisive leadership around their experience, that internal, you know, locus of control, if you will, about I'm going to impose my will on this particular outcome is very fascinating. It's something that I often had to remind myself of talking about my experiences is being an active participant in my own destiny. You know, when you live in a world where things are swirling around you, it's easy to feel like, well, I'll just get picked up by the tornado and it'll drop me off wherever it will. And hopefully I'll still be in one piece. I'll be okay. Right.
Yeah.
And it required an active investment of energy and mindset to develop that this will not happen to you today. You will be an active participant in your own destiny. So as a mantra that I lived by for a very long time in my career to create that mindset, and manufacture something that maybe didn't come quite as natural to me as it did with others. But you do mention the compete level and seeing, you know, that orientation towards competition for better and for worse, because it spills into card games all the time and very high stakes golf games.
yeah, right.
But I'm reminded of two. One is a very serious example of truly what it means to compete, and then the other is a little bit more funny. But I'm reminded of Kenny Powers when he says that I'm an athlete. I'm not trying to be the best at exercising. And it reminded me of a line of Ken Dryden, who's one of the Hall of Fame goaltender, Stanley Cup champion, but also an incredibly cerebral guy, member of Parliament in Canada. He actually, we trained together as he was in his retirement in his 60s, but we would train at the same facility. And, we're talking about, this and that. And he's like, people assume that I like to work out because I was an athlete. He's like, but I just like to compete. And this is, I hate working out. I did it so I had the chance to compete.
Yeah.
And also it's probably a mindset that you see that separates a number of athletes, that without that conflict, constructive conflict between each other, it becomes a very different ask to get them to be physical and use those physical skills. And replacing that competition level going forward into looking at life outside sport, life outside military, there are very few scoreboards that are as effective and direct at giving that feedback back to you on where you stand every day. And without that level of competition, finding meaning becomes difficult as well.
That's what we see the most, in our transitional issues. You do have a significant component dealing with operator syndrome and all of the substantial medical effects and affects of the job and the experience, from TBI to PTSD to endocrine issues. So, all the actual medical realities to subjecting yourself to long durations of intense external exposure, right? Where those pressures on you, whether it's, getting blown up, whether it's getting, two or three concussions a season, whatever those are, those begin to, become, like you said, I love the term locus of control, right? And those pressure points pushing you towards that questioning of that competitive spirit. And I think we're seeing that substantially right now as a result of COVID and as a result of, I've been working with the Penn State men's lacrosse team for the last few years. And, last year they went to the Final Four. They were in the semi against Yale and lost. And they had two players on this team that were all Americans, top leading point earners in the thing. Well, then they came back for their senior year and it got shut down. And I can only imagine that sensation of not feeling the sense of feeling incomplete. Right. And I think that is a condition that is very challenging, right? Are we going to get some type of, like you said, are we going to ascend to a point where we can look at ourselves in the mirror as we're transitioning out and say, I'm happy with what I did. And I think that's becoming more and more difficult now, because some people are, even their careers are being cut short, their times. What would you say to athletes right now that are facing these kinds of dilemmas?
Yeah, it's a difficult spot, because a lot of athletes are being put in a position they didn't think they'd be in. Like, it's the equivalent of a career ending injury without having the injury, in many ways. So you don't even really have anything to, kind of blame it on.
Right.
And it goes back to, you're kind of starting behind the eight ball a little bit. And I talked about the divestment, right? And the performance wellness aspect. And, one of the things that I really try and get my athletes, mindset around is recognizing the value you have of divesting that interest to your actual performance. Like I talked about my initial story of like doing other things, finding other things you find value in, actually is a performance enhancing experience. While it doesn't directly do, okay, you're not working on this particular aspect of your physical performance, you're not watching video, you are doing things that are increasing your connection to others, you're increasing your perspective, your cognitive flexibility, your self-awareness, that's increasing that self-efficacy. You're taking all that stuff with you. Of course, you're gonna perform better. It's actually not as counterintuitive as one might think. Wow, I spent the day, donating my time or reading about something or, performing in a play, I don't know, right? But yeah. Man, did I ever feel good about that? And man, do I ever feel free to do whatever I want to do next? So really, I talk about that with our athletes, in that the best way to ensure you get the most out of being an athlete is seeing where it fits in a greater whole, rather than solely identifying with one aspect of yourself. And we, you know, it kind of ties in our entire conversation now, is because we kind of get told as kids that, well, you got to harness everything to this boat and live in that boat only. And we're not going to worry about other aspects of your life, because this is all that people technically value about you. And all you should probably value about yourself as well. So, you know, what we're really trying to do is kind of break down some of that mythos and recognize that, you know, through athlete development, you know, through this support that we're doing, we're actually trying to be a performance enhancing, you know, resource as well. Our goal is to get the most out of your athletic experience. And part of that is leveraging your athlete experience to check out other parts of the world and use that platform to go and experience things, make a difference in areas in your community. A big area, we see a lot of athletes making huge philanthropic initiatives and taking on some amazing things, making great change in our world. And to say that that is an isolated incident that doesn't impact their performance, I think is a bit of an oversight, and you miss the value that actually has for that athlete to perform at their highest level.
Do you think that sometimes athletes can get too carried away with that aspect of their life, right? Where, obviously it can become a gross exaggeration of their lifestyle. It can become, you know, a distraction when they're in the news for all this other stuff that, you know, you're bearing the burden of this year, I've never seen an athlete get more pummeled than LeBron James, right? LeBron just got annihilated this year for his social advocacy. And you know, as a result, it's obvious less people are tuning in. So here he's exploring that other aspect of his personal identity, but it's dramatically affecting the interpretation of performance too. If he's always this social warrior and he's playing like crap or whatever, you know what I mean? And these athletes, I think everybody's kind of not sure where to take it. Are you seeing that in the athletes that you're working with? They're a little bit fearful of exploring outside this box that the antiquated style of conditioning a person's mindset towards that higher level of play.
Yeah, it also kind of goes back a little bit to, you know, our positions within, you know, the hierarchy of the sports jungle, so to speak, to use that analogy. And a number of people are afraid or feel that they don't necessarily have the authority or right to actually explore some of those things. And we're trying to create a greater environment. You know, I kind of, even just from a business perspective, we talk a lot about, you know, making athletes CEOs of their own brand, right? You are the CEO of your own company, of your own brand.
That's great.
And how are you using that and leveraging that? And, you know, the NBA is probably the leader as far as their athletes and providing their athletes with a platform to identify and resonate with causes that have meaning to them and allow them to explore that. And they do a great job. And, you know, from LeBron on to, you know, Steph Curry, you look at a number of these athletes who have leveraged their platforms to do things that they're interested in, whether, you know, we're certainly seeing a lot of the social justice advocacy happening. We're also seeing a number of guys getting involved in certain business ventures, industry. Entrepreneurship is a huge thing we love to see, and it's a natural fit for a lot of athletes because, you know, they're used to a mindset you only get out what you put in. If you want to be an entrepreneur, you better be willing to put in, you know, a lot of hard work before you get anything back, but it's yours. And, you know, we're seeing a number of those athletes who are leveraging their experience and making an impact in things that they care about, far greater than we would normally have seen in decades past. And, you know, that is part of a changing and shifting culture in sports as well. And, you know, that I think that's both, you know, from an economic perspective, but also from an athlete development perspective, and recognizing the true power that athletes have to leverage their exposure and the impacts they can make in their communities.
Well, I think, you know, it's with the advent of social media, it's really become a powerful tool for people, right? You can cultivate this this personality in conjunction with the advancement of your skill sets. And the higher you get, the, you know, the more followers you get, the better you're doing. But it's also, it's, I think it's also developing that creative aspect for individuals as well too, should they choose to use it in a positive way. Right. You know, there's this little, there's this young girl who's probably 12 or 13, who's a skateboarder surfer. And she just recently did some stuff with Tony Hawk and did this huge jump. And, you know, the girl's got like a million plus followers on Instagram. And you start to see, wow, the intensity of that. Is that aspect of performance, that diversity, that divested identity you're calling, is there a probability that young athletes can't balance those two well? And that they seem to forget, hey, listen, I need to get to the place where I've accomplished what I intended to set out, but I'm spending way too much on this other stuff over here. Do you see that happening quite a bit?
I can't say I can speak to that specifically, but what that does kind of trigger for me is finding the balance in an athlete's kind of career, coming back to more to that individual experience. And I kind of look at it from my experience, a very, very isolated look at it was you know, how loose I had to be to play well and when I was too loose.
Right.
I guess it's a very, you know, kind of compartmentalized version of what you're talking about. And how do I ensure that, you know, my priorities and my actions are aligned with my goals? And what do I seek to achieve here? And what do I actually need to do to be my best? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a part of this, where there's a number of aspects where athletes can kind of be mindful and fearful that, well, I'm losing focus, I'm doing too many things. And often talk to my athletes, specifically when we're talking about athlete development and doing things outside the game, we have to recognize that it's a very individualized experience. And one particular athlete may have a tolerance for doing a whole bunch of stuff outside the game. Another guy might have an hour and a half a week.
Right? You're either Dennis Rodman partying in Vegas before the finals, or, you know, you're Michael Jordan shooting 1,000 free throws before, right?
Right. And everyone has a different, you know, kind of mindset in order to be prepared to do that. And part of that is that self-awareness aspect and exercise and recognizing what I need to be my best. Right. So understanding that that's an individual journey and not necessarily what other people think you have to do or should be doing. And imposing that on yourself, but rather, again, becoming aware as to what you can tolerate, what becomes that, you know, optimal zone of development, right? When too much is as bad as not enough in many ways. So I often use that example to go to a real athlete experience. We said I needed to be loose, but not too loose. Too loose was as bad as being too tight.
Absolutely.
You know, finding that balance in an athlete's life is a product of just doing a little bit of that work and internally and working in a little bit and understanding what brings you value the most without overextending yourself, you know, or over investing in certain aspects that are, you know, malaligned with feeling good all the time. So, or at least for primary important time, nobody can feel good all the time.
Yeah. Right.
But, you know, obviously we look for wins to be trends, right. And, you know, bad days and bad games to be one-offs, and, you know, what kind of behaviors and what are the things I need to be doing to ensure I'm trending and only one offing my bad days or bad games.
I love it. I mean, that's in, I think the evaluation processes, you know, the variables that are out there are improving dramatically. And one of the metrics, the psychometric assessment, which I love that term. It just fired me up. I was like, well, that's an awesome term, psychometric assessment. I dig it. And that comes from Dr. Larry Cash, who invented Success Finder. That you sent me that evaluation. I didn't know it was quite as long as it was. So at about 11:30 last night on my third thing, I kind of was like, all right, I got to go to bed, man. I'm going to be wiped out. But can you tell a little bit about, because what I'm hearing from you is that we're all individuals. And there is a framework of performance that can get us, but, you know, great coaches, great agents, great mental skills coaches, great sports psychologists, great whatever, parents, they need to find the nuances of the individual in order to set them up for the greatest success as possible in that particular role. Can you talk a little bit why you found such great confidence in the Success Finder program?
Yeah, absolutely. So Success Finder is it's a behavioral analysis tool that I've kind of adopted in my practice across how I work with clients, whether I'm working with athletes or corporate clients in a recruiting context or in a performance context, or even in a more of a wellness traditional, you know, kind of counseling role. I use this tool very, very liberally to better understand my clients and help align them for success and acclimate their fullest potential. And Dr. Cash had a really, you know, kind of interesting idea. He was very interested in success, as you know, 40, 50 years ago, and trying to understand the underlying dynamics of successful people. And he realized very quickly in his pursuit that success is very complicated, and it's often very subjective to what an individual is doing. The long story short, the you know behavioral psychology, industrial organizational psychology side of it is that high performing individuals within a given field will share a subset of behavioral traits that distinguish them from people who don't get those results. Very quickly, there's often a behavioral signature that we can identify in high performing individuals within a given field, whether that's military, sports, teaching, law, you name it. Generally, if we're looking at enough data, we're able to identify some key behavioral markers that are highly predictive of success. And this becomes, you know, a very important exercise, you think, in a recruiting context. Obviously, we want to be attracting people who are aligned and feel very natural and comfortable in the ways they're going to have to behave to be good at it. And from that, you know, you're able to really start to better understand an individual and help them align, orient, and recognize some of the behaviors that may be helping them, but then also some of the behaviors that may be, you know, potentially holding them back a little bit. And if we can start to help stimulate some interventions around, hey, well, how do I become, you know, more structured in my workday? You know, how do I actually, you know, value competitiveness, you know, versus a far more initiative, intrinsic goal setting, you know, motivational style? If you're going to be in sports, you better be extrinsically motivated or it's going to get old very quick.
Right, right.
So while having that natural orientation increases your likelihood of success, recognizing that it's an area to develop can also contribute to your development as well. So I use the tool to really know my clients, you know, cut through a whole bunch of stuff very quickly, recognize where their signature strengths truly are, what comes natural, and see how that aligns with what they want to do with themselves and where they fit. That might be in the current career they're in. It might be in a career that they aspire to be in. We'll recognize very quickly what's going to work for you. What are those tools you're going to play to? And then here are a couple ones that you might want to sharpen a little bit or be mindful of, because whether you like it or not, the probably behaviors are going to be part of every day for you in that particular field.
Interesting. You know what? You know, the behavioral sciences were my first introduction. That's the first time that I was just like, oh my God, you know, this is profound. And then over the last 20 years of just trying to understand more, you know, obviously, you know, there's a lot of resistance against behavioralism in modern psychology. And I think what ended up taking me really by storm was when I got introduced to Martin Seligman, you know, in positive psychology. And really, you know, I remember the first time I went through, there's a guy named Tal Ben Shahar, who's an Israeli. He's got the Happiness Project and all that stuff. And he used to teach the positive psychology course at Harvard. And they posted it online on YouTube, and you could watch all 36 modules of it. And it was fascinating to me because it wasn't one of those things that like, all right, you know, we're going to just teach everybody to be peppy, you know, and teach everybody to be, you know, hoo-yah motivator, right? No, we're going to actually look at some defining personality or character traits that affect your behavioralism, right? And whether or not you do have a capacity for a positive visualization, you know, do you have a propensity? Can you alter the self-talk in your house, in your mind, to be more positive than negative? And then, can you repeat this? And these are some of the principles that you guys are using at Game Change. Can you explain how you approach the individual from now knowing as much as you do about all of the variables, and what are the benchmarks things that you latch onto? Do you find the positive attributes and try and build on those, or do you try and attack you know, whatever, you know, I don't want to call it a disorder, whatever inhibitors they have, and go after the negativity. How do you look at it?
Yeah, I find one of the things that I look at, and I'm very mindful to say that, you know, all behavior is contextual.
Great.
All behavior is purposeful. So even the most maladaptive patterns from the outside do serve an individual purpose, and understanding, I think, that perspective is so important to recognize and working with people, and it prevents you from working against people. You know, in addictions counseling, you often, you know, see that there's a lot of, you know, why did you do that? You know, you can reframe and use the exact same words, but ask it very differently. And then tell me how that helped you.
Like, yeah. Awesome. Yeah.
Right. You know, not shame on you for doing that, but rather, you know, what happened? Help me understand how that behavior was purposeful. In the same way with behavior, I like to look at, you know, first of all, we focus and emphasize the positive ones, like I call the signature strengths, the transferable skills in our athletes, what's working for you. These are your skills that you go to every day. And we want you to put you in a position to engage them, recognize an opportunity. Let's say, you know, someone is an incredibly highly visible, inspirational, expressive person. We want you capitalizing on that every day. You know, I don't want you being quiet in the corner. You know, I want you out there talking every day and feeling good and recognizing this is your natural self and this is where you're most comfortable. And at the same time, I also like to really bring, you know, attention to those potential, you know, aversions or behaviors that don't come as natural. You kind of mentioned one that does stick out for, you know, for me to work with people is managing themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, you talk about self-talk, you know, usually for me, that's, you know, a reflection of self-acceptance and, you know, usually high guilt, very high accountable people tend to be pretty hard on themselves and, you know, can chastise themselves in a way that, you know, somehow if they throw themselves hard enough at the wall, they'll bounce back harder. Kind of realized in my experience personally and professionally that we're more tomato than rubber ball.
Yes, we are.
You know, recognizing, you know, and working with that and understanding how that's purposeful and how that's helpful gives us the freedom and opportunity to do something about it rather than saying you need to be more positive with yourself is not particularly, you know, a helpful recommendation, but helping me understand, you know, where some of these self-talk patterns come from, how they've served me and helped me, and then maybe consider some alternatives is I think a far more proactive and compassionate and positive strategy to help align people to achieve their best selves. And I always say that my goal is to make you feel really good about exactly who you are, have that confidence. And as that's, you know, works with the athletes, whether we're talking about performance or transition preparation, we're really talking about, you know, recognizing opportunities to engage in how you're hardwired, right? Those natural behaviors that come, you know, usually are probably very attributable to your success. Think of things of athletes, you know, that achievement seeking mindset, the industriousness, the work ethic that they bring, the results focused perspective. Usually there's a very strong sense of character that we see in an ability to overcome adversity, which is that very traditional resilience pattern, that grit we see that, no, it doesn't exist in our lexicon. And we're willing to go over and over and over again to get the same result where most people may say, hey, it could be another option here. Maybe I should try.
Right. This is getting painful. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, we kind of reflect that back to them in a way that says, hey, do you realize you see these tools that you're bringing? Like, these are very attractive. How do we build a narrative around these? You know, how do we, you know, actually communicate these? Because that's an area that needs a lot of work in athletes and military alike, is our ability to communicate with clarity in an organizational corporate setting. You know, I often say our life was, you know, 85% what we do, 15% what we say. Mm-hmm. In the corporate world, it's 15% what you do, 85% what you say.
You have to
talk a game to get an opportunity where you're used to a culture where, you know, there's actually an aversion to talking. Being a big mouth, right? So, you know, reflecting that back to them, how do we build, you know, effective communication strategies around these natural strengths? You know, how do we actually show that these have enormous value and how do we leverage them both in the game and outside the game can be an incredibly powerful self-awareness experience. And that's how I use the tool to really work with my athletes in a development perspective and, you know, help them truly recognize. And then that helps us kind of engage and understand what's the why out there, right? When why I want to be involved with a particular charity or a particular small business or cause or whatever the attraction is to that, we understand and can recognize because it's paying me this way. And those incentives aren't always, you know, wealth driven, security driven. There's humanitarianism, there's service, there's fraternity, adventure, all of these ways that our work pays us. And if we can better articulate, recognize what we like to get out of work and what that work is giving us, we're going to be in a better opportunity to be successful.
You know, and I think that's a beautiful aspect, but man, one thing I've seen is that it's just hard for these young athletes to, you know, to understand the power of that, right? Because, you know, at the same time as you have people like yourself that are promoting this greater, this greater totality of process as it results to self-actualization, right? It's a big mission. We're big, complicated human beings, and we got to assess all these things in real time and be willing to make the corrections as it relates to, you know, our better mental health or better emotional health, as well as the physical, right? The rewards. But there's always those old school people that are out there going, I don't give a shit what you're doing, man. You need to perform on the ice. You need to perform on the field. You need to perform here. And all your little stuff you're doing, it's just, I don't care. Your performance doesn't cut it. This is a business. You need to go right yourself and get on there. Is that, do you still see that as a pretty extreme reality to that next level, right? Not so much college, there's the hoo-yah there. You're still doing it for your college team. And most players never even go beyond college, but man, that transition to professional level, that's a tough shift.
Yeah. You know, you're right. And that is really an old school mentality. Certainly as I was, you know, coming into pro, it was still very, very adopted. But as you said earlier in our conversation, the sports are changing.
Yeah.
And you know, the stakeholders, they're starting to see the value in this, especially, you know, if you look at a global scale, right. If you're looking at, you know, like Australia and you're looking at Europe, and New Zealand and some of the things that they're doing around cultivating the holistic development of athletes.
Let me just hop in real quick. It blows my mind. I never imagined it was as worldwide as substantial in North America. Like, but a friend of mine, Dan, brilliant guy, former Dev Group guy, doing some great stuff with leadership out there. He had the All Blacks. He worked with the All Blacks, right? And it's like, well, why is this, you know, traditional old school and rugby, you know, old school mentality, right? We're going to go out there and we're going to brutalize it. But now they're seeking, you know, leadership counseling from a former SEAL Team 6 operator. They're integrated in one of the top sleep doctors from Australia, Shoshana Halson or whatever. I forget where her name, I always butcher her name. I'm sorry. But, you know, it doesn't matter. Sport is really kind of, in some capacities, leading the charge on this, the comprehensive nature of performance. And I think they're really pushing it into a lot of other industries too. Are you seeing that?
Yeah, I really am. And it is ironic because some of the sports like Aussie rules football and rugby, you know, traditionally, you know, identified as very brutal sports in the contact level and the violence that exists, but the holistic approach they take to developing their athletes is really inspiring and, you know, is really leading the way. And North America is certainly starting to follow and recognize that. And I've talked a little bit about the NBA is one that's done a fantastic job in supporting their athletes and, you know, of expanding their interest, their scope and their reach. And getting that stakeholder support is so important. And that's kind of where the research comes in as well. And we, you know, kind of being mindful of exploring how all these dynamics, you know, interact, not only with performance, but also with the wellness, recognizing that, yeah, while being an athlete is a very limited time and very important time in an athlete's experience, it does not, you know, cover the entire trajectory of their existence. Certainly their career arc and self-development, it's something that's ongoing. And if we can contribute to that while they're athletes, not only are we doing something positive for their wellness, but we're actually probably going to get more out of them too. I think it's a mindset that this is beyond an altruistic thing that, you know, you should do because it's nice. But rather stakeholders are starting to see the benefit of having athletes feel good about themselves, involved, It creates more productive, more, a greater sense of well-being for people. And the more aligned you are, obviously the performance is a natural thing that should follow as well.
Yeah. That was the thing that was really kind of special about, you know, the year I got to work, you know, with 18, when I worked with the Sox that year, as my third year with them. And, you know, that world championship season was, there was just a difference in mindset. There was just a different approach to it. It was holistic. It was a different mentality. The pressures changed. The reactions to things changed. They helped isolate their players a lot better from attacks, external attacks. They did great jobs taking senior, players that have been around and uplifting the younger guys. So there was a greater continuity of focus and a difference in a way they assess the pressures of the grind of the 162 games and so on. And then once the intensity of we're going to break the records of wins, we're going to break the records of this, you know, managing all that well as well too. So you really see teams making this push towards this type of conscientious intent, right? Hey, we're going to take better care of our athletes. The question I got for you is, let's say a coach is listening to this, an athletic director is listening to this, whether it's high school, college, or even a professional manager or general manager, you know, how do they begin developing a program like this at their school or on their team?
That's a great question. And, you know, a number of organizations, leagues, associations have some pieces in place and are starting to develop these, but it becomes with that overarching understanding that this isn't just about tomorrow, right? These programs and these resources for our athletes and are something that we really want to, you know, be contributing to today and to tomorrow for these athletes. And in that, we're getting the most out of their experience and we're providing them with the greatest resources for their development. So, you know, really aligning with some champions is obviously every you know, new cause, innovative cause requires a champion. And having those pivotal people that people listen to is a critical step I found in aligning and getting people, you know, to listen and to consider new ways of doing things. Sports tends to be, a little bit more conventional in its approach. You know, it's part of that determination mindset, right? Like, it's not broken. We just didn't work hard enough. And it's very effective. We don't want to change things. Changing things means that we're giving up. So that's part of understanding, you know, working with a mindset rather than working against a mindset. Mm-hmm. And really having that and understanding, you know, and speaking to that development of those individuals, knowing those players, putting them in positions to succeed, allowing them to be their authentic selves. Right.
Do athletes know what they are, who they are though? I mean, when you were in the locker rooms at all the levels you were at, could you generally look around and say, yeah, 90+% of these people in this locker room actually know who they are?
Well, I think we're just like everybody else. In any other workplace, I know we do something very unique, but you know, as we talk about in the mental health space, we're just as susceptible to the, you know, the pitfalls and realities of being human as everyone else. Some guys are incredibly self-aware and unapologetic. Other guys, you know, probably have little awareness about, you know, who they truly are and are trying to, you know, portray a certain way in order to survive or to fulfill a certain aspect of themselves. We come in all shapes and sizes. But it's about, you know, being, you know, authentically seen and heard, mm-hmm. In a way. And it kind of ties into, you talked about your great experience with the Sox and gets into a little bit more of a team culture, mindset and perspective and developing cultures. I'm far from an expert on developing team cultures. There are a lot of experts out there, but you talk about reaching a certain level within a team culture where, you know, there's this exceptionalism and a level of professionalism and commitment and performance and maturity. And I often
such a great word, Jay, that is the word right there, you know, and I have this theory that, you know, the sooner you get your child locked into one of these crazed, you know, programs where they're training every night, they're training on weekends, they're training with strength and conditioning coach, mental skills coach, the specific target skill set coaches. They're playing on 2-3 teams in their high school and their travel team and their whatever. And man, we're literally just putting the blinders on these kids to that potentiality. And we're driving them deeper in this hole of performance that they're forgetting all these other critical aspects to their development.
Yeah, that's a great point. I have a lot of colleagues have a vested interest in youth development and sport and what's happening to the professionalization of youth sports. And there's a real disconnect right now. If you listen to a lot of former professional athletes, they talk about being multi-sport athletes growing up. Even you look out of the research in Australia, most of those athletes didn't realize they were going to play professional rugby until they were 19 or 20 and make a solid commitment to that. But we're seeing now that, you know, an overvaluation of being good versus the experience and participation in sports. And, you know, if I can soapbox it for a quick moment.
No, please, please.
But, you know, I think, you know, from, you know, if you looked at sport from an evolutionary perspective, if it was just about being good, and only for a handful of people, well, then it would have been gone. It served no social function.
Right.
Right. But sport has obviously been a part of our culture since we've, you know, started, you know, and it still remains a huge part of our life. Clearly there's something about it that has nothing to do with performance and being good. It has to do with, you know, the lessons that we learn and the experience to fail well and, you know, to fail forward and learn those valuable lessons of life, you know, and then take them out into the real world. It's a very safe, you know, microcosm. So I have found that there has been this overemphasis on being good. Well, there's no point in playing if you're not good, which has really, you know, I think impacted the youth experience of sport, and we're really missing some fundamental aspects. But the catch 22 of it, and you know, as a parent, I can speak to it, you get really stuck in this tough spot because with the professionalization of sport, you have to be good to get exposure to the highest levels of development.
Yeah.
Right. So when I was a kid, when you were a kid, I could make a soccer team because I was an athlete. Teams were picked on athleticism, mm-hmm. right? I didn't have to skate all summer in order to make a hockey team because right. I was a good athlete and I was still exposed to the highest level of development. Now they're not picking on athleticism. They're actually picking on skill specific things. Like, you know, I've even heard, you know, 8 or 9 year olds talk about hockey IQ. Baseball IQ at 8 and 9 years old.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you're not playing 11 months a year, you're not going to be able to have acquired the skill to get exposed to the highest developmental level, right? So the kind of environmental individual interaction that happens there, that you kind of, as a parent, you're like, oh, holy smokes. Now I have to, my son or daughter have to pick a sport at 7 if they want to have any hope of having some degree of success in the game.
Right.
You know, again, it becomes this black or white decision that you have to make on behalf of a child at a young age, which is an uncomfortable place to be. And I feel is, you know, is a difficult spot. So I understand the problem with it, but the solution isn't just like, oh, well, I played a lot of sports when I was a kid and I was fine. So, you know, your kid should too.
Yeah. Right. That's right.
That doesn't capture the true, you know, issue at hand, in that unless we make some fundamental cultural changes around what we value about youth sport, nothing's going to change because parents are going to be continually driven to expose their kid to the highest level of development, and kids want that. But it also requires a huge sacrifice in a number of aspects of their life. So it becomes a bit of a runaway train.
Absolutely. No, yeah. No, it's that was beautifully put. I mean, that was probably the most eloquent I've ever heard people put it before. And, you know, and I've not only dealt with this, you know, dealing with youth athletes and trying to help them and the burnout and watching that and the pressure and them just hitting that point and dropping off. And then I'm, you know, I've got my own kids, right? You know, everybody is in soccer. It's the one sport everybody's playing. School sports are shut down, but soccer youth leagues are still going pretty good down here. And, you know, the little ones, they just show up and they're kicking the ball and they're great. You know, well, our oldest has moved into these travel teams, and, you know, the team they're on right now, there's two teams. There's a white team and a blue team. The white team is playing in, you know, the national tournaments, the sub-regional tournaments. They have 5 players on the Olympic development team, these young girls. And it's like, now we come back and we hear the pressure, you know, on our daughter and, you know, Jonna, captain of women's field hockey you know, at University of Maine. I played at lacrosse at Penn State, you know, so both athletes plus the stuff I've done in professionally, you know, and it's like, okay, this is what we're going to do. Let's talk about, you know, field IQ. Let's talk about defense. Let's talk about 1v1 versus zone orientation. Let's talk, you know, and she's 12 years old. You know, this is her second year ever playing soccer. She's still like, she's just a natural athlete, and she's able to compete at these, at this level with these people who've been playing for 6 years because she just, she's a great athlete. So it's like, where am I and what do I do? And where do I go after that? And how do I, you know, and I think this is, this question is applicable at all levels, you know, is when you see somebody that has a propensity for that, that work ethic, they're willing to make, you know, what's the big quote is, are you doing the work when no one's looking, right? Are you doing the reps when no one's looking? Are you reading the stuff? Are you watching the video when no one's looking? All that stuff. It's like, man, you know, how do you assess the player and when they're ready? How do you apply the pressure to reallocate their attention away from maybe what the vested identity to a more focused approach and recognition that, hey, there are certain stair steps we have to, there is a process in order, you have to perform at X level to get a look.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I come back, a couple of things come to mind, a very Eastern philosophy: when the student's ready, the teacher.
Beautiful, man, I love it.
And we like to force it a little bit, but I often tell parents, and you know, I get, you know, triggered a little bit spending some time in some youth rinks, and seeing, you know, clearly there's no alignment between the kid's experience and the parents' expectations. But I come back to a very, you know, in business and in finance, there's a KYC, know your client.
Mm-hmm.
I use a KYK, know your kid.
Yeah.
Know your child. Hey, that's my version. Say, know your child.
Yeah.
And recognize, you know, that as a parent, you know, meeting that development potential, that zone of development, of optimal development is what's critical, right? And too much is as bad as not enough as well. And really having that mindfulness around, you know, there's a whole bunch of great programs out there around mindful parenting and sport parenting. There's a number of advocacy groups because, yeah, we, you know, we can get a little bit caught up and a little bit carried away in the professionalization of that youth sports. It's a huge investment. You know, certainly when you start talking about, you know, $5,000-$15,000 per year in youth sports, any other investment like that, you would demand a return on it. So probably not surprising that, you know, you might get caught in a little bit of that mindset as well. But understanding what kind of development your child needs to truly fulfill and maximize their potential is so critical. And that might have been different than yours as a kid.
Huge.
They are their own, you know, person, they are their own people. And recognizing that, I think, is, you know, as I reflect on my personal experience with my kids, I reflect on my childhood and a number of those factors is recognizing that, like, I asked my daughter if she wants more grounders and she says, I'm okay.
Yeah.
I'm like, no.
No, 20 more, 20 more.
Never turn down extra work. And I'm like, oh, wait a second. That's the old patterns talking. That's me. That's fine. We've had enough today and that's what you needed.
Oh, that's right? So awesome.
You know, finding that. But then there are kids that will literally, they'll play till dark and they'll go on and then they'll go into the basement and do more work and they'll go and do that. And recognizing that and being mindful and responsible with our kids and especially in sports is critically important. Recognizing that the most value they'll get out of the game, regardless of what they do, is how far they get at an accomplishment level. The most they'll get out of the game is what they take with them into the other aspects of their life.
Amen. God bless. Well put, brother.
Even at a professional level, I still look at that. My job now is to help people recognize, you know, their experiences in sport and how they transfer them into other aspects of their life and how what they've learned through sport has been attributable to their success. So, you know, it's not just about, oh, minor hockey or minor, you know, sports, collegiate sports. Even at the professional level, we're still doing the same thing. We're still extracting the same meaning out of our experiences, just at a different competition level.
I love that. Extracting your meaning out of the experience. And that's really critical. And it's critical to understand what choices you need to make to possess those experiences that allow you to do that, right? Let me direct it at you specifically now. Obviously, you recognized early on that you wanted to, you know, not just be confined to a particular internal evaluation, right? I'm not just an athlete, man. I have this big, beautiful brain up in my head. And that drove you to do what you're doing now. How do you take the lessons you learned as a competitive professional athlete and apply them into the world that you're doing now, right? Which is clinical psychology, research, really trying to optimize to help people acclimate their true potential. You know, how have you done that?
So yeah, that's a great question. And I like to say that it was just like this amazing process, but part of it was very reactive for me in realizing that I wasn't just a player because, you know, at that point in my evaluation, I wasn't really fulfilling that. It was a positive response to go out there and proactively pursue something else. So, you know, recognizing that it just wasn't always this what I wanted it to be. It was really a process of my experience as well.
Were you let down by the experience at all?
Oh, well, yeah, certainly I would be lying if I wouldn't say there wasn't some unfinished business coming out of the game. And we all kind of experienced, I mean, I'm not distancing my experience. I don't speak for everyone, but certainly had a ton of unfinished business, certainly dealing with the loss of that part of the self as a very much a grieving process. You know,
beautiful
very
plan.
Much like you lost a part of yourself that made you angry. It made you happy, made you sad. I actually just, you know, kind of put together something that I'm hoping to, you know, maybe even publish. It's the story of your athletic journey, and it's kind of a journaling exercise. It's about, you know, 75 different journal prompts that takes you, you know, to reflect on that meaning of sport through your life.
Oh, God, that's brilliant.
You know, just to get that expressive writing component to process the memories, to integrate, you know, and reflect back on what the experience meant to you, where it fits into your life, what you're taking from it with you. To put it in a place where, you know, like you say, in grief counseling, you know, you hold on to the love, not to the loss. And that part of our career, I think, is something that a lot of athletes could benefit from. But, you know, part of this experience is recognizing that how I was able to get to the level I did as an athlete is what's going to make me successful in other places. So that determination and discipline component, I found that in my life, I'm really, really good at practicing.
That's cool.
And I can embrace the suck better than most people. I wouldn't necessarily say that unless I saw some data that suggested I hang on a little bit longer. Maybe I just don't learn quick enough.
Right.
Different. But I recognize that my ability to embrace the suck and stay committed to the long game is a real strength. And that gives me that motivational persistence and patience to see things through, like getting, you know, obviously advanced degrees now as, you know, as a licensed counselor now, and as, you know, completing my PhD now, you know, hasn't been an easy road, and it's a long road that required a real sustained level of commitment, but I recognize so too to being a professional hockey player.
Oh,
and
God, yeah.
My road to the National Hockey League wasn't exactly direct and linear. And there was a lot of suck in there along the way. And I use that as fuel and recognize a number of those aspects. Certainly having to manufacture confidence when you maybe didn't really have it. I have experience doing that and can leverage that going into a room with people who are experts. And, you know, feeling that you have something to contribute and having the confidence in your ability. These are just a few of those transferable skills that I recognize served me so well in my career that are largely hardwired. And I want to leverage them and embrace them while still capturing a couple other ones that, you know, maybe didn't come quite as naturally. One of the things athletes don't do is initiate independently. You know, surprise, surprise, you know, like military, we prefer to be told what we're to
always going. Waiting for them orders.
Yeah. And we become very good. And sometimes it actually gets misinterpreted as initiative because you go work so hard and execute so well, like, wow, you're a real go-getter. Well, no, I didn't really go get anything until someone told me to.
Exactly.
You know, so how do you reframe that question? Why am I doing this? What's it for? And acting of your own volition, that sua sponte, there's a great military.
Absolutely.
Well. I actually have come to really appreciate and use that mantra, sua sponte, acting of one's own volition, and being self-autonomous and self-directed in our behavior because we want it.
Yeah.
Becomes a very unexercised muscle that, you know, you need to constantly get in the gym every morning and be mindful to.
Well, let me ask you this. All right. So, I mean, you don't commit yourself for as long as you did without that love for competition, right? That love for camaraderie. I mean, that was a big one for me. You know, why did I keep coming back to, you know, a career where life and death was, you know, the normal aspect of your decision tree? And it was, for me, it was really about that sensation of purpose, that sensation of mission, that sensation of camaraderie, the trust, right? There's no better trust than knowing somebody will take a bullet for you, right? That's just, it's an empowerment significantly, or somebody will step into a fight for you in the ring or on the ice or wherever, or, you know, even in your business, that somebody will stand up for you, you know. And how do you then take, you know, those desires, those aspects of kind of that hardwiring that you're talking to, and then translate it into where, you know, it's, I don't know if mundane's the right word, but a little more, the pace is slower with helping an individual on a psychological level. The wins aren't the same. The you know, the victories are incremental. You know, how do you assess that shift?
Well, that's an important part. We kind of talked about the scoreboard,
yeah,
a little bit, of changing the scoreboard. And, you know, you have two components that you really hit on: that fraternal nature, the camaraderie, being a part of something bigger than yourself, is often lost and hard to replace in that way. You know, sports and military are very unique cultures, and even being on a team isn't necessarily the same. But that requires that insight and that reflection, and you've got to do the work a little bit and understand, you know, I've often said to some athletes, you know, they would go to the field or to the rink for 2 hours for a practice day, and then they'd go home and they would feel complete. And then some of them are now in work, they're working 8 hours a day, they're driving their kids to sports, they're being a husband, they're doing this stuff, and they lay down in bed and they're like, I didn't do anything today. And it's like you kind of reflect that back to them and you realize that, you know, the measuring sticks are very different in the purpose and the value of what you're giving yourself, right? And that's something that, again, is a required shift in a little bit of that mentality and integrating, okay, well, how I used to evaluate myself is a little different. Maybe I expect too much, and that's okay. And it can sometimes feel very icky to say that, well, you know, you don't have to be the best in the world.
Lower your standard.
Yeah. And even just even say it like that, I even cringe.
It was hard for me to put it out there.
Yeah, it's hard to say that you know, like, you know, having a little bit more balanced approach and recognizing that it's a bit of a longer play, and that your ability to impose that will on things is a little, you know, maybe less, you know, in those aspects of your life, and being okay with your new place. You know, you hear guys that don't want to be average, or don't want to just be, you know, a normal person. You know, there's an aversion to that mindset, and, you know, finding a new place and meaning within what you're doing, maximizing your contribution, while recognizing that you're never going to be able to keep score in the same way, is always a challenge. Like, there's no recipe for it, right? It's just, and again, I don't really attest to that there is a direct prescription for that. Here, go do this, and then it's gone. That's not how it works.
No way.
Right? Process. It's a path made by walking. And you're going to come up against it time and time again, you know, like transition, you know, 3 years into my transition, you hit a pothole on something bubbles up to the surface. And, you know, it's, you kind of got a little, you know, it's a little bit of an observation, and, you know, and recognize the pattern and breathe through some things and, you know, and get back on track a little bit rather than working against it, you know, and fighting and resisting all the time, which works so good for athletes. You know, it doesn't necessarily translate. Again, as I said, behaviors in one context don't necessarily translate to another. And some of the things that make us really great athletes, some of the things that make us really great officers and special ops don't necessarily translate well and require a different form of exercise in the behavior mental gym in order to become more fluent with, right? And you don't have to deadlift every day.
I think that's the great challenge, right? We become conditioned. We're incredibly adaptable to conditioning, right? Especially if the programs are good. If the programs work and we see results or we feel results, we think we can start to think a little differently, and then, you know, the expectations shift, our perspective shifts, right? Now all of a sudden we're like, wow, this program's awesome. But the challenge is which program works for you, or do you need a completely individualized program? And how do people begin to assess that? What are some just initial sequences that people can jump into to say, all right, this was my identity for X amount of years. I invested thousands and thousands of hours into it. The mindset, everything, the body, the physical, spiritual, mental, emotional, all here. Now all of a sudden I'm on this side of the end zone or the blue line or whatever euphemism you want to use. And now I have no idea what the game rules are. How do people, what's a good way to begin that assessment to get a better understanding of your, you know, your, you know, all the things that we're measured on now, our IQ, our EQ, our, you know, our ability to succeed, our ability to integrate socially, culturally, all these things.
Yeah, pretty interesting. You used your example, and people, I don't know if they'll see on the podcast how you used your hands to kind of, you created two areas, but there was an area in the middle that you missed.
Yeah, the transition.
One identity right to the other. And in some of the research in athlete development and other areas, we call that a liminal experience. Mm-hmm. This you know, kind of concept of being, you know, betwixt and between. I'm not what I was, and I'm not yet what I'm going to be. And it's very uncomfortable. And, you know, a lot of people find that in the reintegration and the re-exploration where, you know, I'm really exploring, but I'm not particularly committed to anything. And how we do that and how we go out and give ourselves the freedom to be vulnerable, to learn something, to not be, you know, the best or smartest person in the room is a very difficult experience. And it's not going to be easy. It requires courage. To do it. Speaking from my experience, I mean, I don't claim to be the most, don't assume that I'm the most courageous person in the world, but it took vulnerability to be, you know, a psychotherapy student working with psychiatrists. And, you know, effectively you get told to go back to your sandbox. is how I kind of put it. And I was like, wow, that was humbling.
Yeah.
But you take it and you go back and you make the best damn sandcastle you can.
Right. And you're like, look, see, I can. Right? Yeah.
So there is a humbling component, and finding that is really what I think the most important. And as you said, there's a whole bunch of different ways to get there, right? It is a path made by walking. And the most important part that I've found is developing a relationship with someone. Mentorship is important.
Amen.
Someone who sees you, right? Someone who somewhat understands your lived experience, doesn't necessarily have to have directly been through it, but, you know, at some level, you know, has a true empathic understanding of your experience as it is. They don't necessarily need to have lived it to say, oh, well, this is what I did. That's not always helpful either. Mm-hmm. But someone who can truly reflect back, you know, what you're experiencing in a way that makes you feel understood and heard and accepted.
Yeah.
To help you kind of navigate and chaperone these experiences and help carve out a roadmap forward. And that looks different for everyone. You know, someone might resonate with a particular individual or a program or a structure, and that's great. But I think integral to all of those, what you're really ultimately finding is mentorship and a freedom to, you know, kind of create that space to go out and explore safely and to know you have a little bit of a guardrail around you and someone to fall back on and help guide those experiences, maybe even make a, you know, kind of a little bit of a leap. You know, programs are very helpful in making introductions, social networking,
yeah,
getting some exposure to tell your story. I often say that, I mean, one of the analogies, I'm an analogy guy, in case you guys, people haven't noticed, you know, athletes in military, I find a lot of people, they're like jumbo jets. They can soar for 10,000 miles. They have so much potential. but we often forget about the 1 mile of tarmac we need to get in the air. Every jumbo jet still needs a mile to get up in the air. Yeah. You get them in the air, they can soar 10,000 miles beautifully, gracefully, yeah, so much potential, but they will always be grounded unless we, you know, actually have the runway and build that and the resources and the infrastructure to get that plane in the air.
That's beautiful, man. That's about as good as I, you know, it's so funny. I take notes, you know, during my interviews as well too. Cause, and I've got like 15 things you've said that I get to, that's like triple the amount I usually have. So it's just, Jay, you're espousing real wisdom, man. And it's just so cool to see, somebody, you know, it's always tough. I found that in the transition is believing you belong in that next realm, right? That sandbox meant that sandbox euphemism is profound, because it's like, all right, I'm going to come to the table with all these people that they've written, you know, 25 medical journals or psychology journal entries. They have this much 30 years of research, all this. And, you know, you step into it and you're like, man, I'm green on this thing, but man, you have all this other experience. You just don't know how to translate it into that new identity quite efficiently. So it's just really cool to see you do that.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And I think you've captured kind of the message beautifully, is that, you know, I often tell players and athletes and even people, you know, like, what you don't know can be taught, but what you have, you can't find anywhere else. And some of those things that you've, you know, acquired through a life of experience in a highly specialized environment are far more transferable than you know, and far more sought after, and admired, revered, respected, and cultivated, you know, within organizational cultures. Let's just ensure that you have the ability to represent that experience and articulate that narrative. One, it's important, yeah, to give you the meaning, mm-hmm, out of it, right? To make meaning of your experience. And then two, it provides you that platform to share that and becomes a very compelling story that's required to cultivate new relationships.
Yeah.
Right. And part of, you know, the great aspect of all of these like podcasts, what we're doing is we're really telling stories. And every time you tell it, it changes slightly, but that's part of the process. And that's how it works. And that's how you actually get to the refined meaning of it all. So I appreciate the privilege, the opportunity to chat with you and, you know, asking me questions that has allowed me to work through my process, which is ongoing.
Well, I just think, Jay, you represent the future of what we're talking about. You really do. You're out at the forefront. You're at the tip of the spear, to use a phrase from my world. And you know, I think the greater opportunities that come to you to be in front of the NHL, to be in front of the NBA, to be in front of the NFL, to be in front of, you know, collegiate programs. I mean, think about the impact that this could have at the collegiate level. You know, you go into the University of Florida, or you go wherever, you know, you have, and you say, hey, listen, you know, we've got all these wonderful young people that have all these very positive skill sets. All right, let's give them the other tools then to translate those skill sets into a very positive and contributive identity for their futures too. I just think it's just brilliant, man. I think you're doing amazing stuff, brother. What's coming next for you, Jay? What do you have going on, and where can people focus on following and hanging out and watching?
Certainly, I kind of can maintain a little bit of a lower profile. Certainly, heavily focusing on the academic component of my work, and you know, getting some supportive research for some of my beliefs, and truly understanding and conceptualizing, understanding and contributing to the athlete experience in that respect. Getting the opportunity to work with some professional athletes as well, and then finding my balance, finding my home, Dave, is really important. I'm a young father and husband, and finding, you know, that place is incredibly important, and it's work. It requires work to turn off some of that competitive mindset and those juices, and or reapply them into that particular aspect of your life. But as I say, I like to work out, but I recognize how much I need to work in.
I love that, man. That's so good.
You know, that is definitely what's on the horizon for me, you know, continually to expand the messaging and the platform to help as many athletes as we can, both at an individual and a more global level. At Game Change, that's something we desire to do inherently. We see this performance wellness as, you know, related, but not synonymous. And we can work on them and they can both coexist together. And that also spills in. Game Change is really, you know, starting to develop some very unique offerings in the first responder space and how we can cultivate similar performance wellness, because the mindset is so similar in that in the identity component tied to getting better at what I do is all I'm really interested in. It's all I really want to talk to you about. So if we can focus on the performance aspect and increase awareness, resilience, cognitive flexibility, social support, then we're doing a world of good to our most important, you know, people out there on the front line. So we're recognizing how this sports model really translates into the first responder space as well. And I think we're going to have a few unique opportunities to do something pretty special there as well. So it's very exciting in bringing this particular philosophy of living and of being and developing and performing. And it's still very much a work in progress, but I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it today. That's for sure.
Well, I'll tell you what, Jay, I mean, every time I have the opportunity to just spend any time with you, I learn always a tremendous amount. And I just love the way you deliver it too. You're passionate about it. You're conscientious about it. You're not intrusive with it. And most importantly, you bring a real positivity that there is a pathway for everybody, right? On this path that we're all walking. And there are, you know, relatively, you know, not overly complicated systems that are available that we can advance ourselves and really start living our best lives. And man, you bring that every time. And I just can't thank you enough, Jay, for coming on, man. God bless you and your family, brother.
Oh, bless you. Thank you. And it's been a privilege. Thank you very much.
Now, if your brain is reeling as mine was during that interview, then you're doing all right. Because Jay, I tell you what, not only is he incredibly insightful, but this guy understands what it takes to become a high performer. I think his insight on the power of knowledge, the incredible blessing it is to really dedicate yourself towards your own personal wellness, as well as your team orientation and wellness, and understanding the sacrifices that are a part of becoming a tier one level performer, or even just a performer in your everyday life. I mean, his insights and his experience are just remarkable. So if you want to know more about Jay, please go visit him over at, he is the director of assessment at Game Change Athletic Development Services and Consultancy. He also is a vice president and director of athlete integration. He's a certified success finder practitioner. I took a portion of that evaluation. It's very good, very cool. This guy is just, I mean, he's out there living this truth and trying to help people become better performers in every way. And he has the background, the intelligence, and the drive to be able to help you. So go check Jay Harrison out. You won't be sorry. Again, also, you know, if you're interested in knowing more about what we got going on, we're still kind of without a social media home after Parler got shut down. Again, free speech. And I'm going to keep hammering this free speech thing as much as I need to until we can see some type of pulling this back from the grips of really a totalitarian mindset. Also, pay attention to the elections and what's going on with the For the People bill that's in the House. You got to check that out. You got to read what it's saying and taking the power away from the states and states' rights. So be aware of that. Also, you know, go check out the website at teamfroglogic.com. You can see all the different things I've got. The Frog Logic Institute, our Embrace Fear training course coming up in mid-February, as well as the Forging Self-Confidence course that should be at the end of end of February, and then the operator syndrome course that we're hoping to have done by April. Check all those things out. And then, you know, please continue listening to the Frog Logic podcast and spread the word. Again, I'm not out on social media. I kind of lost access to about 100,000 people, which is a little heavy, but tell your friends, man. Tell your friends, tell your family members. If you see someone struggling with any type of the things that have to do with the intensity of the human condition under extreme environments, whether it's athletic performance, professional performance, relationship performance, whatever it might be, I'm trying to really dig into shows that are going to help people through the difficult times as I remain positive. Again, also did a recent interview on the American Free Range podcast with Evan Hafer from Black Rifle Coffee, a good friend of mine, just such an awesome human being, and for having me on. And I will be going back on that show, I think, in February. Not sure what we're going to discuss this time. Evan always likes to hit me out of the blue. But I bet this time it'll be a lot more directed and focused on how to improve yourself in a bunch of different ways, with a lot of humor in there as well, too. So I just want to say thank you to Jay Harrison. People like you out there are making a huge difference in this crazy world we're living in. And I really appreciate all the work you've done on yourself and the work you're doing for other people. It just means the world to me that you would take the time and come on the show with me. I just can't thank you enough. Also want to thank all my listeners out there. Without you guys, my following has certainly dwindled. But you know what? I'm going to keep on trucking. I'm going to keep doing the show, keep putting out curriculum. That's going to be our main focus. And we just want to provide you with all the information we know, John and I and Chris and other people that are contributors to developing the curriculum. And we want to be able to help you when times are tough. That's what Frog Logic is. Frog Logic is a way of thinking that when you're getting pounded by the negative insurgency, I mean really devastated, that you can go and you can look at some of the performance concepts and training concepts that I've been developing over the past 30 years that will help you. These things are proven, they're tested, and they work. Again, I'm not here to sell you 6-minute abs or teach you how to make $1 million in 30 days, but I am here to tell you that life is about suffering. It's about managing that suffering with some very effective tools so that you can walk that pathway of pain in search for some relative peace in your life, that you can maximize your potential, and most importantly, that you can feel some sensation of meaning through the power of your relationships and your activities and your performance. So thank you to all my listeners. Thank you to God. Thank you to Christ. I mean, that's the ultimate performance right there, isn't that? The ultimate performance. So thank you for showing me the way. Thank you, Jonna. I love you so much. Thank you to my children, my family members. Thank you to all my friends who helped me over the last several months really kind of get through my tough time. Hopefully old Ruddy Rut Rut is back and in the saddle and going strong nowadays. So thank you all for that. And God bless you.